Welcome back to the program. It's safe to say that one thing that the left and right both have in common with respect to religion and public life is that they both have it wrong. The defining myth of separation of church and state was not what the left thinks it was, and the Christian influence and power that the right fantasizes about is not all that it's cracked up to be. The truth and the history is far more complex, more nuanced, and some would argue more troubling. We're going to discuss all of this today with my guest, David Sahat. He's an assistant professor of history at Georgia State University and the author of a new book entitled The Myth of American Religious Freedom. David Sahat, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. This mythology about religious freedom, about separation of church and state, it being a sort of founding principle of the country, how did that myth first begin to perpetuate itself?
Well, it's sort of complicated. The founding fathers, particularly Jefferson and Madison, they really wanted a separation of church and state. And of course, Jefferson came up with the idea of a wall of separation of church and state. But the First Amendment didn't apply to the states, and most of the connections between church and state occurred on the state level. And so there was constant religious conflict as a result of this. So this sort of idea of church-state separation went in two directions. In the one direction, Protestants said, in the face of Catholic immigration in the 1820s and 1830s, that we in the United States, because we're a Protestant country, have separated church and state as opposed to Catholics. On the one hand, early on, it was an expression of Protestant sectarianism and an expression of anti-Catholicism. And then on the other hand, there were dissenters to the many connections between church and state, secularists or people who were just left out, who were calling for the separation of church and state, which meant something different than what Protestants wanted. They actually wanted a true separation of church and state, so stopping praying in schools, no longer prosecuting for blasphemy, all of which was common. And so this idea of separation of church and state was a kind of rhetorical sword that both Protestants and people who dissented from Protestant power drew upon from very early on.
And of course, as you mentioned a few moments ago, it did not apply to the states, and they were free to do and in fact did many things that in fact flew in the face of that idea of separation.
That's right. Yeah, they the most obvious one is that there was which is I guess surprising now, but in a way, not so surprising. They prayed in schools. They read the Protestant rather than Catholic Bible. They did have all kinds of essentially Protestant devotional services. There was this argument that that Christianity was part of the common law, and the common law was a sort of an evolving body of law that came from Great Britain, and that continued in the United States through case law, the decisions of judges. And what that meant was that, in some sense, Christianity received special protection in law. And then, of course, there were several states after the First Amendment that actually continued to pay churches out of the public treasury, and they were free to continue to do so. And they continued to do so up until 1833, when Massachusetts was the last state that stopped paying churches. But they could have changed their mind after 1833 and started paying churches out of the public treasury again. And so what we see, if we look back at this history, is the state, various states, using state power to perpetuate and to protect Protestant Christianity in any number of ways that Protestants, of course, celebrated, and non-Protestants, either Catholics or various kinds of secularists or even some liberal Christians, objected to.
And what impact did that have in terms of actually holding people back that didn't subscribe to that Protestant ethic?
Well, they were penalized in all kinds of petty and not so petty ways. The way I came to this, to realize this, was I was reading a 19th century free thinker, to use the parlance of the times. He was an agnostic. His name was Robert Ingersoll, and he traveled around through the late 19th century, so well after states had stopped paying churches, but still weren't when Protestant power was still profound. And he was a lawyer, and he traveled around the country giving these lectures that called for the separation of church and state, and he pointed out that he was admitted to the bar in New York and in Illinois, his home state, but that in many courts throughout the nation, he couldn't give testimony in a court of law, even though he was admitted to the bar, because he could not swear an oath in which he said that he believed in God and a future state of rewards and punishments, which was required in many, if not most, states in the nation to give testimony in a court of law. So that sort of is an indication of the kind of problems that developed. The state was kind of officially supporting a Protestant Christianity, and so it left those who did not support or could not claim to be affiliated with Protestant Christianity, who couldn't say, I believe in God and a future state of rewards and punishments, in a kind of basic way, the law didn't protect them.
And yet, one of the things that's so interesting that you talk about is that going back to the founding, what a small percentage of the population even affiliated with a church.
Yeah, this is a sort of puzzle. Back to the founding, there was in 1776, historical demographers and sociologists have shown that anywhere between 10 and 20% of the population belonged to a church. And so at least early on, it made a certain amount of sense for the state to sort of pay for churches, because the fear was if the state sort of got out of the religion business that churches would collapse. But what happened was shortly after the Revolution in the 1790s, and particularly in the early 19th century, religious expansion exploded. And historians, of course, today call this the Second Great Awakening. And this awakening was the large-scale birth of evangelical Christianity, which is a form of Protestantism. But it's a form that is devoted to the individual's relationship to God, and believes that when the individual sort of turns to faith in God, that he has or she has moral obligations that should be lived out in life. And so what happened was that the laws and the sort of social arrangements, the social and legal arrangements of the Revolution were in place, and then evangelical Christianity exploded, and the evangelical belief in the relevance, the public relevance of their religious ideals, was perfectly poised to take advantage of this legal environment, and evangelicals moved into the public sphere and began directing laws that accorded with their moral ideals, and so. Very quickly, evangelicals were opposed to the state paying churches because they thought that propped up their religious competitors. So that's why states stopped paying churches, was basically because evangelicals objected to it. But evangelicals did not object to the connection of religion and law. And because they were increasing in such rapid numbers, and because they were able to combine and mobilize in a way that others were not, they were able to kind of take control of the state and use the law to protect their morality, which then provided a basis for religious power, basically.
And what happened around 1940 when, in fact, the states were under obligation to separate church and state to a larger extent?
Well, so there's this long history along with the growth of evangelicals, and that's the history of dissent. This was never a consensual and agreed upon arrangement. There was a kind of a constant level of pushback from people who objected to it. Robert Ingersoll, the guy that I talked about earlier, is an example of that. And throughout the 19th century, this dissent grew. But in the early 20th century, the dissent changed with the beginning of progressivism and progressive intellectuals especially. These progressive intellectuals are sort of the founding fathers of modern liberalism. I'm talking here about Herbert Croly and Walter Lippmann, Walter Weil, who founded the three of them founded the New Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And these progressive liberals in the early 20th century began to coalesce around the idea that it was the responsibility of the courts to protect civil liberties, and that one of the most important civil liberties to protect was the freedom of religion, and that that required the separation of church and state. And in time, this idea made its way first through these sort of progressive intellectual activists up through the Supreme Court, beginning with Brandeis and then Holmes, and then continued to build on the court until 1940. And in 1940, the court began hearing, prior to 1940, it had begun hearing these cases that involved Jehovah's Witnesses. And what the Jehovah's Witnesses claimed, they were part of, they were Protestants, but they were oppressed by Protestants. And they objected in particular to this these laws that were on the books that required them to go get a permit to go door to door to evangelize. And what the laws said essentially was that whoever decided whether they could get this permit, if they were a religious cause, they could get the permit, and if they weren't, then they couldn't. And so this allowed some bureaucrat somewhere to essentially say what was religious and what was not. So the Jehovah's Witnesses took them to court, and in 1940, the Supreme Court decided two things. One, that the First Amendment applied to the states. That was, and in particular, that the religion clauses of the First Amendment applied to the states. And the reason that they decided this was, since the Civil War and since the 14th Amendment, it sort of gets a little complex here, the 14th Amendment nationalized citizenship in order to use the federal government to protect freed slaves in the aftermath of the Civil War. Prior to that, prior to the 14th Amendment, you would be, say, a citizen of your state. So I would be a citizen of Georgia. And that would be the most important citizenship that I possessed. But after the 14th Amendment, I was a citizen of the United States, and the federal government had obligations to protect my rights of citizenship. But it wasn't clear exactly what those rights were. And over the late 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, the court began to consider that the rights of citizenship were found in the Bill of Rights. And by 1940, the court had decided that the religion clause of the First Amendment, so the protection of freedom of religion and the promise that the state was not going to establish an official religion, that was actually part of the essential rights of citizenship, so it was the responsibility of the federal government to protect those rights. And so in 1940, the Supreme Court applied the religion clauses of the First Amendment to the states. And that meant that all the various connections between religion and the state that had existed back from to the very beginning, that suddenly those were going to have to change. And over beginning from then 1940 to about 1968, the Supreme Court began through a series of cases to enact the separation of church and state.
And of course, one of the impacts that had is to create a tremendous pushback to this on the part of Protestants and evangelicals.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Because what Protestants and evangelicals in particular, they defined the freedom of religion maybe differently than the progressive liberal activists of the early 20th century defined it. The progressive liberal activists defined freedom of religion as both freedom to exercise your religion, but also freedom from religion. So someone who didn't believe would not be obligated to deal with religion as a matter of public policy. Well, that's totally the opposite of what evangelicals saw as freedom of religion. Freedom of religion was the ability to exercise their religion, which to them meant bringing their religion into the public sphere. And so what happened was that in 1943, first in 1942 there was a sort of exploratory meeting, and then in 1943 the National Association of Evangelicals was created. So this is 3 years after the Supreme Court's case that applied the religion clauses of the First Amendment to the states. And what the National Association of Evangelicals was designed to do was to bring together evangelicals across the United States in order to bring back and fight for evangelical ideals in public life. And the argument was that the United States has a kind of millennial mission to the world. It's God's favored nation, and God had created the nation to enact his purposes in the world. And so if the Supreme Court was permitted to continue in separating church and state, evangelicals felt as though this would disrupt God's purpose for the nation and ultimately turn the United States away from its original purpose and into some kind of despotism. And so the pushback from evangelicals, which eventually became the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition and the Values Voter of 2004, began almost in tandem with the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions to separate church and state.
And in many ways, this is responsible for so many of these culture war battles that we have been fighting, we thought, since the 60s, but really since the early 40s.
Exactly. And even before that, really. If you go back and you read an evangelical like Lyman Beecher, who was an evangelical in the early 19th century, and he his progeny are very famous and important, especially Harriet Beecher Stowe, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin. These moral campaigns that began all the way back in the 19th century and that were sort of revived in the 1940s. I don't want to say that they're a kind of a cynical ploy for power. They're an absolutely legitimate expression of evangelical belief in the idea that God has required them to come into public life. But the net effect is that evangelical moral ideals and the attempt to use the state to promote those moral ideals perpetuates Christian power in a way that uses the coercion of law toward religious ends, and many people find that troubling. But there's a kind of much longer history of the culture wars, and I think the way to think about the culture wars is that evangelicals, in particular, now joined by some conservative Catholics and others, want to go back to the past where church and state were connected, and in which they used the state to wield religious power.
But, of course, part of the way they make that argument is basing it on the Founding Fathers and their ideas, and that's where they go astray, because that's mythology as well.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, the Founding Fathers, in a certain sense, there's a number of problems with appealing to the Founding Fathers. I mean, the one problem is, who counts as a founder? So Jefferson is obviously a Founding Father, right? But, actually... and of course, Jefferson is a favorite of liberals. But actually, Jefferson wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. He was in France. He was the ambassador to France. And when he first read the Constitution, he actually didn't like it. And when he and Madison were corresponding while the Constitution was being drafted and afterwards, and he persuaded Madison to push through a Bill of Rights. And even then, when he read the Bill of Rights, he didn't like it. And John Adams, who conservatives love to appeal to, because he actually favored the support of religion by the state. He was from Massachusetts. He liked the Massachusetts model, which paid Congregationalist churches. But again, Adams wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. He was certainly a founder, but he wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. He was the ambassador to England. And he also had serious misgivings about the Constitution when it was perpetuated. And then the other problem is that Adams actually strongly disliked evangelicals. So it's this weird thing where evangelicals appeal to someone like John Adams when you can go back and look at what he's saying about evangelicals in 1816 and 1817 in the midst of the Second Great Awakening. And he's got serious concerns about what he viewed as a kind of dangerous religious enthusiasm that would yield demagoguery. So sort of on both sides, the liberal and the conservative appeal to the founding fathers, I think, is misguided.
And what is the broader danger, as you see it, from this mythology that exists on both sides as it relates to the arguments that we're engaged in today?
You know, I think when liberals and conservatives appeal to this false past or this inaccurate view of the past, what I think the net effect is that it introduces a kind of pervasive sense of falseness in our contemporary debates. You know, if liberals continue to say, well, the founding fathers separated church and state, I mean, that is false. It is just false because all of the church-state issues appeared on the state level and the First Amendment didn't apply. And likewise, when the conservatives sort of look back to this happy Christian past, they obscure the essential coercion of the past. And so not only are liberals and conservatives sort of talking past one another, there is almost no basis for a kind of productive conversation. And so it yields this really dispiriting debate that you can see in the present that's not going to go anywhere because it's based on these myths of the past. And I think the first step to having a productive debate is to have an accurate view of the past, and then we can maybe have some discussion about maybe the proper role of religion in the present.
Over the years, to what extent have people gotten it right? I mean, have we ever had this debate with a serious understanding of what these historical antecedents were?
You know, the time when I think the debate was maybe most clearly had and most authentic was from the 1920s to 1940. And this was the period when the liberals on the U.S. Supreme Court were in the minority. And they saw clearly this religious coercion of the past. And they began to point it out in various ways. And meanwhile, the people who wanted to keep it, they were well aware of these past connections. And so we're having a more, forthright or robust kind of argument about it. But very quickly, after 1940, because of the presence of the Cold War and the feeling that we were battling godless communism, this sort of frank acknowledgement by liberals, and I think the falsity actually entered the debate through liberals, not through conservatives. Liberals began, on the court, began claiming that they were not engaging in some kind of transformative use of the law, which they were. Mm-hmm. Instead, they said that they are the unique protector of American liberty, and they had to do this because of the political context in the Cold War. And then from there, it sort of continued to get more and more fuzzy. But if you go back to the very beginning of the debate with the liberals and conservatives in the 1920s. I think that's probably the closest that we've come to having an honest debate, and it's because it was the tail end of real robust religious power in the United States, and so liberals were more honest in saying we need to use law to transform this arrangement, which actually impinges upon American citizenship if you're not in the Protestant moral establishment.
And of course, as the debate has gone on, it has become more and more mythologized by conservatives who do it under the context of this originalist idea.
Yeah, now I think we're at the point where conservatives' use of the past is bordering on, if not outright, nostalgia. And, you know, nostalgia is a sort of a dangerous basis for public policy because it obscures a lot of the limitations of the past. And I think it also obscures the fact that when you use law, you are using the coercive apparatus of the state. The full force of the state will be put forth to make sure that the law is put into effect. And so when conservatives look back and they see a kind of happy and consensual past, and they say that the founding fathers were religious and wanted to create a nation that was comfortable with religious sensibilities and in some sense in which religion was robustly in the public sphere as it had been up through most of U.S. history, and we just want to return to that, I think they're really obscuring the fact that what they're calling for is to use the full coercive apparatus of the state to put forward a particular religious vision, and I think that's very dangerous. And so the main thing that I'm trying to do in the book is it may be true that the mid-century court went too far in separating church and state. Maybe it's true that the expulsion of religion from the public square is was too much. But the court did so in order to reduce the coercion of the state upon people who did not agree with the Protestant majority. And I think that's still a legitimate purpose, and that has to be the starting point for any productive conversation going forward.
David Sahat, the book is The Myth of American Religious Freedom. It is just out from Oxford University Press. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.